We began this pandemic as the team of 5 million. We were the envy of the world, going to school and to the office, even going to crowded concerts and sporting events, and we successfully kept the virus out. We thought that was the hard part. But then came Delta. Getting everyone vaccinated and avoiding quarrels and finger-pointing turns out to be harder. All over the world, COVID has created an epidemic of tribalism and virtue signalling, says Dr. Vinay Prasad. He's an associate professor in the epidemiology department at the University of California in San Francisco. He wants to have a different kind of conversation about COVID, free of shame and blame and entrenched attitudes. And Vinay joins me now. Hello there.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to talk to you. So we are 71% fully vaccinated, 87% with one dose, but we've given up on the COVID-19 elimination strategy, apparently, here in New Zealand. Was that inevitable?
Yes, I do think it was inevitable. I mean, I think that this is, for many, many months now, it's been the case that this is an endemic virus, and it's unlikely to be eliminated, or even a small nation very committed to the task is unlikely to keep it away out of the shores for a long period of time. So I think that was inevitable, yes.
By the way, has our experience here in New Zealand keeping COVID at bay for so long made it more difficult for other countries to manage expectations around the virus?
That's a good point. I mean, I do think that many nations looked to New Zealand with envy for a long period of time. And there were comparisons that would naturally be made. But I do think some of those comparisons were probably a little bit off the mark, in the sense that there are lots of differences between a place like, say, New Zealand, or even Australia, or the United States, or Singapore, or Spain, that has to do with the geography of the place, the cultural attitudes of people living there, the trade-offs people are willing to accept, and even something that hasn't been talked about too much, but the seed load, which was back in March of 2020, when we didn't really know for sure how many cases were on the ground. And that might have been fundamentally different in a place like the UK or the US as it was in New Zealand. And that might have sort of, to some degree, cast the die from that first moment and might have been hard to replicate at other places.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Can I ask if you approve in theory of our government's latest plan, which is to wait for 90% double vaccination and then open up with pretty decent freedoms, particularly if you're vaccinated? The unvaccinated will be kept out of a few sort of social and public events.
I guess I do support that some threshold be used for sort of a reopening. Whether or not it should be that threshold or a different threshold, I think, to be honest, I guess I don't have the answer. And I think to some degree it's a leap of faith, because no one has really robust data that that's the magic number. But I think something like that is a reasonable strategy above beyond a certain threshold that things should be liberated.
There's plenty of argument about it here. And you have said previously that medicine is rapidly becoming a tribal field. Can you tell us how you've personally experienced that?
Well, I suppose I would say that there are a number of issues throughout this pandemic where the right answer was, well, here's our best guess. We don't know for sure. And these are some studies we can do to reduce uncertainty. But you didn't hear that too often. What you did hear much more often was, this is the right thing to do, or this is the absolute wrong thing to do. I guess I'll just give you one example. Something I've written about in The Atlantic is that in the United States, we like to think we're the center of the universe, and we have policies that routinely mask children age 2 and up. In that, those policies that are led by our American Academy of Pediatrics and our CDC are different than the WHO's policies, which are not to mask kids younger than 6 and to selectively mask under 12. And so we in the United States have been aggressively masking 2 and above, while folks in the United Kingdom have never masked a child in school less than 12. My point is just that if we're all perfectly honest, we'd have to admit we don't know for sure who's doing the right thing. We don't know for sure if there's a magic age above which it works and below which it doesn't. And the best thing we could do as a scientific community is kind of run some robust studies to answer that question. But we will exit this pandemic with zero robust studies on that question. We will not know anything more than we did when we entered it. And that, to me, speaks to tribalism. In the United States, that's an incredibly divisive issue. People feel strongly that it must help, or strongly that it is a bad thing to do. But nobody is really sort of meeting in the middle and saying, there's some uncertainty here. Let's acknowledge that.
Yeah, that's so interesting, isn't it? And I suppose the the best argument against what you're saying is that when you need to get everyone to do something, it pays to make the messaging really simple and unequivocal, right?
Some would argue that, but I would say that that comes at a big price, which is if you are very consistent and very clear and very unequivocal, but you are in fact wrong or mistaken, you will lose substantive credibility for future crises. Mm. And public health and politics is a reputation-based business. It's a long arc. And so, for instance, I'll just give you another example. You know, in the United States, our Facebook, a major platform globally, of course, but here in the United States for communication, it literally prevented you from discussing the possibility that the virus occurred from a lab leak. I'm not an expert in this topic. I don't know exactly where the virus came from, but I think it's problematic if the software prohibits you from talking about it, and then months later, now it's suddenly okay to talk about. They've had to remove the ban. So these kinds of heavy-handed things that are meant to, I guess, create homogeneity of idea, they can backfire and lead to, I think, substantive loss of trust.
In the US in particular, I think to lesser extent here in New Zealand, but in the US it divides along left and right, like unbelievable, really, that choosing whether to use a mask or not can be a way of wearing a badge for your favourite political party. But when you look at those tribes, left and right, do they act as you would expect them to act? Do their actions around the pandemic line up with the tenets and philosophies associated with left and right?
That's a good point. I mean, I guess I would say that first, let me concede your premise is true. If you see someone in the city of San Francisco wearing the mask when they're running outside in the ocean breeze, you know, that's a left-leaning city. Meanwhile, you can go to some places that are right of center and you'll see people in prolonged indoor exposure time not wearing masks. And so it really does have the left-right political valence, in part because we had a very political figure who was our president who people felt very strongly about on both polls. But to your point, does it line up with the longstanding principles? My answer is no. And I'll give you the best example, which I think is school closure. Now, Trump, in the middle of the pandemic in the summer of 2020, he argued that we ought to reopen schools. And as a result of that statement, you saw a dramatic swing in public opinion. And places that are left of center, Democratic-leaning places, are the ones most likely to have had prolonged school closure. And the reason I think it runs up against the principles of the left, of which I consider myself a part, I was about to say my principles, it runs up against my principles because I think one of the fundamental principles of the progressive left is to do the most for the people who have the least in society, to care about the most vulnerable people. And children, particularly children going to public schools in some of these cities, are some of the most vulnerable people in this society. And by closing schools, I fear we did a grave disservice to them, and we will continue to see that in terms of long-term consequences to their health. And so I think that's a place where progressivism missed the mark, where the left missed the mark.
What was the reaction when you came out effectively on the side of Trump that schools should reopen?
I like to say I came out on the side that schools should reopen. I'm not sure I'm on his side, but he happened to be on the right side. And, you know, sometimes, you know, if a broken watch is right twice a day, I mean, sometimes just because someone you disagree with substantively on many, many issues says something doesn't mean they're always wrong. And so, yeah, I think I personally did experience a little bit of pushback and a lot of vitriol. And I think a lot of it was misplaced. I think the reality of principles and governance is that one has to always separate oneself, your scientific self, from your visceral reaction to particular politicians. And that can be tricky to do, but it's all the more important we do at times of crisis.
We have a view of scientists as following the facts, neutrally following the facts, but there is room, isn't there, for politicization in science as there are in other sectors?
Yes, I do fear that it is inevitable to some degree that science and politics will intertwine. I worry that we're leaning into it a little bit more than we need to in the current moment, and I worry about the future of science. To me, when I think about science and policy, I think here's the perfect matrimony in my mind. Science is this field of knowledge where we help delineate the trade-offs. If you do this, you might expect that. If you do this, you might expect this. But policy is where science meets the values and preferences of a group of people. You need the average person in your community to say, what do they value? What are they willing to sacrifice? And what might they not be willing to sacrifice? What trade-offs will they accept and what won't they accept? And I think some of what happened was science and policy was confused for one and the same. And we may not have always done a good job of listening to what people want and being sensitive to their values and preferences. To me, the worst possible outcome will be if we exit the pandemic with two sciences, if we exit with one set of science that says, you know, lockdowns worked, they saved lives, everywhere they work wonderfully. And the other set of science says, well, they never work, they don't work at all. The truth might be something in between. They work really well under certain sets of circumstances with certain types of people and certain populations. They might not have worked so well at other times and places. And so I hope we have a science committed towards finding the truth and not towards validating the preconceived notions of political parties.
I'm talking to Dr. Vinay Prasad, an associate professor in the epidemiology department at University of California in San Francisco. I'm thinking about some of the stuff you're saying in relation to where we're at here in New Zealand. In terms of sometimes if you express doubts or ask a question about something which people feel is settled, then you get lumped into the bad guy category. An example at the moment in New Zealand might be if you question what the limits of a government's legal and moral right to exclude people from public places and restaurants, if you question that, then it's easy to be labelled an anti-vaxxer and part of the problem. So what does that tell us? That we need more appetite for nuance, or what does it tell us?
I think that's an important point you're making, which is that there are more than one value in this life. One value is safety. And a scientist can come around and they can give an argument for which strategy might be the absolute safest in terms of minimizing loss of life, et cetera. Another value in this world is liberty, is freedom. And how you balance liberty and safety has always been a very difficult proposition. In fact, maybe this whole century will be defined by a society trying to reconcile with the balance of liberty and safety. And I think one should not demonize anyone for opening that question up. That is an eternal human question. We need to be able to talk about it and have substantive discussions around it without those kinds of labels or epithets being tossed out. I also think that there are some open and technical issues in science that are still unresolved, which is, you know, when you get target vaccination really, really high, I think it is very likely that you will still have spread of SARS-CoV-2, the virus. It's an endemic virus. There will be some reinfections. There will be some breakthrough cases. What are you going to do about it? What will your response be? Will you continually shut down, or will you wait for harder metrics to be impacted, like hospitals being overwhelmed, before we reinstitute kind of draconian shutdowns? So I think these are sort of really broad, both scientific questions, but also philosophical questions. And I think it would do us a disservice to not speak openly about what might happen.
One tenet of philosophy, which I think is a really crucial one to remember at the moment, is that you should consider the best arguments of the person you are opposing. And so with that in mind, what is the hardest question you can get from someone vaccine hesitant, and what is the answer?
I guess what I would say is... Well, of course, I'm on the side that we ought to aggressively vaccinate all adults, and that we ought to, I think very critically about how we'll vaccinate adolescents. I think that's an important age group. And I think we have to think ultra critically about how we vaccinate 5 to 11 year olds. And I hold my philosophy because I think if you look at the risk in these different age categories, the oldest people have the most to benefit from vaccination, and the youngest people have less to benefit, and potentially some risks such as myocarditis. And I'm hoping for a policy that kind of threads the needle, that maximizes the benefit and minimizes the risk in those younger ages. But I guess to me, when I talk to people who are reluctant to be vaccinated, I think many of the things they say to me, I feel like there's a lot of truth to. You know, some of the things they say is that the companies that develop these products are making exorbitant sums of money. And I want to say, yeah, they are. I know. I agree with you. I've always been critical of the biopharmaceutical industry, of the pharmaceutical industry and their revenue. Sometimes they say is, you know, this feels like it's happened really quickly. And I want to say, yeah, it does feel that way. I think many of us were shocked at how quickly these vaccines were developed. At the same time, I think credit where credit is due. It speaks to the ingenuity of the industry and that the vaccines have done so well. to me, I think one of the perennial misconceptions is that just because the mechanism of action is new means that you should be more worried about safety signals you don't yet see. And in my mind, as an epidemiologist, I think that in my mind, I worry most about safety signals when the number of person years of observation is small. In other words, when very few people and have been exposed to an intervention for very few days. But with these vaccines, I think you're having billions of people exposed with now months on end. You're getting a lot of person time denominator data, and that's actually quite persuasive to exclude, you know, very large safety signals that would outweigh the benefits. So to me, I think the answer is pretty clear for most adults that they ought to do it and try to do it soon for their own sake.
I'll throw another one at you because I make a practice of listening carefully to people's objections and answering them when we've got an expert on the line. So here's another one that this is a new sort of vaccine and we don't have long-term data on what this new RNA vaccine might do to our bodies.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question and it's a good point. And I guess what I would say is in my mind, there is a scale with all new medical interventions, including the vaccine. And on the scale, on one side are the potential benefits and the known benefits. On the other side are the known risks and the potential risks. And as you have a product, as you have years and years of follow-up on a product, you will learn more and more of the things on that side of the scale. But I guess, and am I willing to say that we'll never learn anything about a potential risk that we don't yet know? No, maybe we will learn some things we don't yet know. But in my mind, if you actually sit down and you get the numbers on the risk of the virus and the risk to yourself if you get the virus and you look at your age and you start to stack this scale, I think what I see is that the scale tips in favor of vaccination, even acknowledging potential unknown risks that we do not yet know. We do know that the magnitude of those risks will be so small, it will not tip the scale. Does that make sense? So that's how I think about all these things. I think about the weight of the evidence, pro and against, and whether or not there's anything I don't yet know that could tip the scale. Is it possible we'll learn something new in the years to come? Sure, but I doubt that will be enough to offset the massive benefit to a person, and that benefit is a huge reduction in the risk of severe illness and death of SARS-CoV-2, which is not a risk you face 20 years from now. It's a risk you're gonna face this year and the next year and the year after that, and that's a real risk, and the benefit to you there is quite vast.
So you here are taking these questions and potential concerns seriously and you're doing some analysis on them and coming to a conclusion. The alternative is to be unequivocal and say, you know, you don't need to worry about it, we've got it covered, whatever. In your view, should we take these things seriously? Should we admit the nuance when we see it because it's the right thing to do or because it might be more effective?
I think you have to only be honest when you're a scientist. And honesty means you have to acknowledge when you don't know things. And when people make legitimate questions about, you know, for instance, your point, is there possible you'll learn something long-term you don't yet see? You have to acknowledge that how can you say otherwise? It would be illogical to hold the opposite point of view. And I guess you have to come at this from my perspective. So I've written a book, it's called Ending Medical Reversal. And it's literally a book about hundreds of things doctors believed fervently. And we're not talking about rogue doctors. I'm talking about the establishment, the bulk of doctors. They believed this with a passion. And years later, decades later, they learned that they were wrong. And so so that's the kind of perspective I bring is that everybody in medicine should have more humility. We should all acknowledge that there are things we don't yet know. Now, that doesn't mean we have to be paralyzed and wait forever to make decisions. You can look at the best available evidence, and you can, as I point out with adult vaccination, that scale tips so heavily in favor of vaccination. I cannot think, and I don't even think it's mathematically possible that there are unknown harms that can tip that scale. And so that's, I think, a better way and a more accurate way of conveying why we feel so strongly, rather than just trying to sort of dismiss someone's concerns out of hand. And then the next thing I would say is that, you know, any doctor who's worth their salt knows that when you go in the room with someone and you talk to them about their concerns, you will get nowhere if you immediately dismiss the concern. You need to listen to the concern. You need to, as you argue, put it in the best light possible and frame it in terms of the strongest, I think, framing of the concern, and then say, like, why you hold that view or why you don't hold that view. And I think that's the only way to handle these kinds of questions.
One problem with that is The other side has pretty good tactics, Vinay. They've got memes, they've got selective data, they've got emotive stories. They're using everything in their power online with these incredibly powerful social media tools to turn people against the vaccine. And so shouldn't we employ some of those weapons in the fight back?
An eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. I think I struggle with that, and I don't think that will win in the long run. And I think, I guess I want to say this about the other side, the side you refer to, which I think is the side that, for whatever reason, is vehemently opposed to vaccination. And they have, in many cases, I think, fabricated information to dissuade people from vaccination. And I look at that side, and I do acknowledge it is real, and they have powerful memes and powerful anecdotes. And I start to ask myself, what is the root cause of all this? And I'm not sure I fully understand the root cause, but to me, part of the root cause may feel as if there are lots of social factors that have, I think, hurt some of these people over time, such as income and wealth inequality, such as the feeling that your life is no longer yours to shape, including, I think, a feeling that the elites condescend to you or speak down to you. I think these are all real sentiments and in part driving some of this polarization. And then the last thing I would say is that these media themselves, Twitter and Facebook, in 50 years, they will be looked at the way we look at the tobacco industry from the 1960s. Mm-hmm. They are selling a knowingly addictive product. That product is addicting people based on the base human emotions of fear and rage and jealousy and hate and anger, the emotions that get your attention. And so I think the way I would tackle these people who hold these views is not to fight fire with fire, but to continue to practice the best science we can, convey the uncertainty, but also to work to, I think, take away the power of these social media companies, to work on the root causes of this distrust, be that distrust in experts or income inequality or wealth inequality. I think we have to try to really remedy this. And if we fight fire with fire, I think we risk tearing ourselves in half.
Great to chat with you. Really appreciate it. Dr. Vinaya Prasad, who's an associate professor in the epidemiology department at the University of California in San Francisco. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.